Well, now that we know that those prairie dogs sometimes have bubonic plague, that meal could have gone a different direction.
it sure could have.
This is the Exploring the National Parks podcast with Dirt in My Shoes. My name is Ash, and I'm a former park ranger and the founder of Dirt in My Shoes. I think that the parks are best seen from the trail, and I'm here to make national park trip planning easy.
And I'm John. I carry the kids on the trails, I tell stories, and notice all the things that Ash doesn't care about much, like birds.
Join us as we show you around America's spectacular national parks.
We're sharing our favorite places, fun facts, adventures, and misadventures.
And we'll even throw in a little trip planning.
Let's start exploring!
We are doing something new today, and I am really excited because we've had quite a few requests.
Yeah.
Maybe people are tired of just hearing me and you.
I would be if I was someone listening to me talk.
But we've had quite a few requests of people who have wanted to hear us do some interviews.
Yeah.
And I personally, there's a lot of people we could interview, but I thought, why not start with the coolest people on the planet, which are park rangers?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that park rangers are definitely in our lane.
I know. I'm so excited. So today we are talking to a real life park ranger. His name is Ryan Cooper. He works for Lewis and Clark National Historic Trail.
Yes.
Which is a network of this trail, basically. They have a headquarters in Nebraska, but he works for the Park Service at Lewis and Clark.
Yeah. And he is super cool. He also, I don't know if it's his really the favorite thing that he likes to do, or I'm not sure which one wins out, the Park Service or this hobby, because it's kind of cool. But he is also known as the BBQ tourist on Instagram.
Yeah.
He's so cool.
Yeah. He does barbecue stuff. So we're going to talk to him about that too. So today we want to talk to him about his job as a GIS specialist at Lewis and Clark National Historic Trail, which basically means, GIS, so this is a job that's behind the scenes. A lot of people don't know this is even a job, but basically he maps things.
Yeah.
He's a modern day explorer. He's out there like mapping this trail and doing research on this trail. And as he talks about, he does a few other things while he's out there too. But this is a job that a lot of people don't even know exists. And I just think it's super cool to talk to somebody who does something a little bit different than what you might have thought.
Well, I think it's also really funny, as we were talking to him, he didn't think that some people in the Park Service considered him a park ranger because he's not necessarily a visitor-facing park ranger. However, we definitely think that he is one of the most legit park rangers out there. He's so cool.
I contest that. I think that even the people who work for the National Park Service in the background, even the people that the visitors don't see, like there's a lot of research that goes on. There's a lot of maintenance that goes on. There's a lot of admin jobs that people have to do in these parks. And they are all park rangers.
Yep.
I've never heard that before. So I thought that was really interesting. But today we are talking to a park ranger, Ryan. It's a really cool, unique interview, and we're very excited to share it with you.
I can't tell you how excited I am to be discussing Lewis and Clark with someone who is deep in Lewis and Clark all the time. And so, Mr. Ryan Cooper, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hello, thanks for having me.
We are so excited to talk to you. You work for Lewis and Clark National Historic Trail, right? But you're based in Nebraska.
Based in Omaha, Nebraska, and that's actually where our trail headquarters is located. Our headquarters is co-located with the Midwest Regional Office of the National Park Service, and we have a visitor center with almost our entire staff is located here in Omaha. We do have a few other employees that are located along the trail, but most of the staff are here in Omaha.
Nice. And along with Lewis and Clark, you are also an expert in one of my favorite things as well, barbecue.
I am. Barbecue and grilling. That is, if I'm not working on Lewis and Clark, I'm working on barbecue stuff for sure.
You're the two prongs of the fork that I love so much.
Nice.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. Tell us a little bit about how you got started. You know, did you always want to be a park ranger? How did you get with the NPS?
So no, I didn't always want to be a park ranger. In fact, I didn't even really know that that was an option until college. A buddy and I grew up in Kansas City, Missouri, and a buddy and I in college, we took a trip to Colorado. This is a hilarious misadventure in which we literally drove across Kansas all night to go to Rocky Mountain National Park. We rolled up there in the morning after driving all night, went to a ranger station and got a backcountry parking permit. That's probably the first time I ever encountered a park ranger before. We got a backcountry permit, woefully unprepared. I think we ate all our food on the first night. You know, we didn't have backpacks. We literally just were carrying our tent in our arms as we were hiking the trail. And honestly, we loved every minute of it. I mean, it's a wonder we didn't have some real calamity happen to us, but it was actually a lot of fun. And I think that was the first time national parks were on my radar. And in fact, after that, we had some bad weather on that trip. And so we decided, okay, well, let's head south. So we went to Mesa Verde. We went to Great Sand Dunes. We ended up going on this big circle loop of Colorado to hit all the national parks. And that's really what started it for me. And after that, in college, I started studying environmental history and cultural geography. And that after that, it was all over. I was all about parks after that.
That's so cool. What did you study in college?
I studied geography and history.
Okay.
And I was really, after that, you know, national parks introduction, I started looking at, wow, okay, there's this whole system of parks out there, not just in Colorado, but we have parks in Missouri as well. And I found that there was a place in the Ozarks of Missouri called the Ozark National Scenic Riverways. And that was the first park that was federally designated, federally protected. It even precedes the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. And so once I hit, I went to grad school, I decided that's what I was going to do, a master's thesis on the creation of that park.
Nice.
Then just out of the blue, someone told me, well, there's actually like a student, a seasonal position down there. You could go down there and work and then also do your thesis, you know, at night. And so I applied for the job and got it. And then I was really hooked. Then I was like, okay, this is what I want to do for a living, for sure.
That's so cool. And most park rangers, like, you move around a lot, especially at the beginning as you're trying to find your place in the park service. Did you move around a lot or did you kind of stay in that area? Where have you worked before you started working for Lewis and Clark?
So this is interesting too. So that was just a seasonal job. I was actually there for 6 months. So it was, you know, half a year. I was applying to jobs all over the country, any National Park Service job I could. And I applied to and got interviews at lots of different positions all over parks, coast to coast and everywhere in between. But the one that I came closest to getting was a geographic information systems technician job at Zion in Utah. I got the sense that I was the runner up for that job, and the resources professional that was the hiring official did something very great. I'm very thankful for. She called me up and she said, I would love to offer you this job, but I cannot. And I want to give you some advice and you can take it or leave it. But she says, I want you to, number one, finish your master's degree. And number two, keep trying, you know. And she said, don't be afraid to go work for another agency for a while, get your foot in the door and then come back to the park service. And that's exactly what I ended up doing. So applied to lots of Park Service jobs, didn't get them right away, got really close. And so I ended up joining an agency with the USDA, the Department of Agriculture, called Natural Resources Conservation Service, which is right in that sort of natural resources outdoorsy world, focused more on soil science. And so I ended up going there and working multiple positions, you know, worked my way up the ladder from, you know, a GIS technician to cartographer to geographer to GIS coordinator for the region. That was a really interesting experience. I lived in Reno, Nevada at the time. And so I was able to keep my love of the parks. On weekends, I went to national parks every weekend. I would go to Yosemite or Zion or Lassen Volcanic. So I knew I still wanted to work for the Park Service, but I just needed to kind of build my resume and get some work experience for a while.
Nice.
That's a really impressive resume, too.
Yeah.
You've been all over the place.
That's awesome.
Ash did an episode on becoming a park ranger, and it seems like you have to find ways to get your shoe in the door. That's really interesting. Having never done it myself, you know, but I'm married into it.
I want to talk more about what you're doing now, because I just think that talking about, especially like the GIS, the mapping, all of that is so cool to me. It's a type of park ranger that I think a lot of people don't think about, or like a job that a lot of people don't even realize is out there for somebody. So will you tell us what you actually do at Lewis and Clark National Historic Trail?
So I actually work as part of a team called the Integrated Resources Stewardship Team. And it's really interesting in that it's a variety of different specialists on this team, and we work collaboratively on all of these projects. One thing that's really interesting about the Lewis and Clark Trail, and we can talk about this in more detail, but it's different from what we jokingly refer to as traditional square parks. So the Zions and the Yellowstones and Rocky Mountain and all of that. A trail is this long linear feature that goes thousands of miles often. And the other big difference about a trail, a national historic trail or a national scenic trail, especially historic trails, is that the agency that administers that trail doesn't necessarily own all the land. I mean, we don't own 4,900 miles worth of trail as the National Park Service. It is a patchwork of different agencies and private landowners and tribes, and it's this collection of these stakeholders, basically. And our job is to kind of work with them and to use our influence and our good name as the National Park Service to, you know, hopefully share with them what's special about the trail and get them to protect the landscape and everything like that. So it's a very unique kind of position. It's not like everything within this gate is ours and everything outside is yours and we're going to protect everything. It's a very different kind of mindset than a lot of traditional parks.
I bet you that can get really messy sometimes.
It's very messy. Yes. It's complex, even just understanding all of the different stakeholders or all of the different entities that are out there along the trail. So I've worked for the Park Service at the trail for 16 years and I still learn new things. You know, we'll learn about a visitor center that interprets Lewis and Clark along the trail that we really didn't necessarily know existed or wasn't on our radar and things like that. It's always interesting, but it can be very complex too.
So can somebody hike from the very beginning all the way to the Fort Clatsop and back without like having to take an Uber from one spot to the next or whatever?
The real answer is no. First of all, 70% of the trail, and I actually went into GIS and nerded out and checked this, and it was almost precisely 70% of the trail is water-based.
Oh, because it's
the Missouri River and stuff?
It's the entire Missouri River. It's the entire Ohio River. It's a portion of the Mississippi. It's a huge chunk of the Columbia River. It's most of the Yellowstone River. So it's 70% is water-based. So right off the bat, no, you can't really walk the trail. And Lewis and Clark didn't really either. They were on rivers most of the time. The overland portions too, often they go across, you know, private land, and it's not necessarily a trail that you can just hike today.
Mm-hmm.
Now, having said that, there are huge portions of the trails that are recreational trails that are hundreds of miles long that you can follow. Sometimes the terrain is extremely challenging. The Lolo Trail that starts kind of in western Montana and goes across the Bitterroot Mountains in Idaho is a trail, but it is just, you know, it's very challenging. And Lewis and Clark also experienced those challenges when they were on that same trail.
That's so cool that it's almost primitive.
Yeah, it's still rugged. I mean, if I go there today, I don't have a cell phone signal. That's the one spot on the trail that I actually came face to face with a bear. It's still pretty wild there. And there are places along the trail that are still extremely wild. That's for sure.
So do you go out there on the clock, like as part of your job, do you go out and are you like surveying things or are you checking the state of the trail or what do you do when you're out there?
All of the above. Now, unfortunately, you know, after the pandemic, we do a lot less travel than we used to. But I've seen almost all of the trail. And when we do, we do all sorts of different projects. It could be out there doing GPS work. We've done archaeology projects. We've done a lot of kind of recreational projects, lots of inventories of signs, interpretive panels, things like that. Lots of meeting with partners. And it's pretty interesting. You can be out there on that particular spot along the trail that where I encountered the bear. I was out there with a guy who was actually mapping and finding trail tread from the Lewis and Clark expedition because they followed Native American trails in the area. And so he was mapping that, was helping him out.
Nice. Did you go at the bear with muskets just like they did?
The bear was more scared of me than I was of him. He turned around and ran. And then I'm like, oh, now I need to get my camera and take a picture of that bear. So I was kind of chasing after it. But...
You're like, let me get some barbecue out of my truck. Right.
That's so cool. What a cool job. We also wanted to know, do you guys ever do like reenactments or anything like that? Or is it mostly just people? I noticed it looked like people kind of travel it themselves or stop at certain places that they're interested in. Maybe not. There's like not one big hub necessarily, but.
You know, there's lots of little spots along the trail. And I was going to say, you know, when you ask about, can you travel? Can you walk it? No, you can't. Most people, the trail actually has what's called the auto tour route. And it's a system of highways and roads that have, you know, marked signs on either side of the trail. And that's how most people experience the trail. I don't do reenactments. You know, I'm not an interpretive ranger. There are people that really know that stuff and they get into it. They even like assume an identity of one of the people on the expedition, for instance, and they know everything about that person. So no, I don't do that.
They don't pull from you and make you do that. It's not in your job description.
Get your buckskin pants on, guys. We're going out there.
You know, we have had really good interpretive rangers at our headquarters, for instance, who will portray Meriwether Lewis or something like that. And they have the uniforms and they do a great job. But that's never been my strong suit. I will just say that.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. That's uncomfortable for me.
Yeah.
John would be all over it.
My grandfather was big into scouting and reenactment stuff for mountain man stuff. And so we always set up his teepee when we would go out. We had the drop shirt and the buckskin and moccasins and everything like that. We'd shoot black powder rifles. And so it was an interesting experience. And I'm sure, but like you said, 70% of the trail is water. And so I've seen reenactments where they like try to get the boat's almost exactly the same as Lewis and Clark's crew, the Corps of Discovery would have. And that would have been crazy.
And I was going to say that, you know, there are groups of people, probably like what you're talking about.
Like my weird grandfather. Go ahead, Ryan. Like, just say it.
And there's some, you know, people that are into that kind of thing. There's a group down in St. Charles, Missouri called the Discovery Expedition of St. Charles. And it's a big group of guys and they've built a keel boat.
Oh my gosh.
And they've built all these canoes and everything and they dress up and they go out and do things and they do it very historically accurately. I mean, it's pretty impressive actually. So thankfully, you know, leave that to them and leave the kind of nerdy mapping GIS stuff to me.
Have you ever found any like relics along the way? Because you know they had caches, they would set up caches along the way, or like they submerged their boats sometimes to hide them so they could use them when they came back. Have you found any like Lewis and Clark artifacts?
Now, we personally have not necessarily, although we've done archaeology projects in the past, and we found not necessarily artifacts, but definitely some like signatures in the soil, where archaeologists are interesting in that they hardly ever definitively say, yes, this is X marks the spot. Lewis and Clark camped here. This is it. But they will say it's, you know, it's 90% probability that this is a campsite of Lewis and Clark and things like that. So yeah, there's been interesting things and interesting ways in which they kind of make that determination. You know, they do find some melted lead or something like that and run tests and figure out, you know, this came from this area. There are archaeologists, there are groups that have found things along the Lewis and Clark Trail. There's still a lot of artifacts that have kind of survived the expedition. There's a lot that's not survived as well, but that's the other thing. The artifacts and those materials are kind of scattered in museums and collections across the country too. It's not like there's one spot. And our office has a lot of replicas of things, but nothing really from the expedition.
So when I was looking up stuff about Lewis and Clark Trail, said it spans 16 states.
Yes.
And 4,900 miles.
Yes.
And we've noticed too, like, because we're from the West, when we drive through Idaho or Montana or stuff, I'll see signs saying Lewis and Clark, whatever, here. We've been to Fort Clatsop, and I think that's pretty much about it. Do you have like a favorite spot along the trail or a favorite section of the trail?
Yeah, I was thinking about that. And, you know, there are lots of favorite spots. First of all, since I'm from Missouri, I should probably say, oh, it's Missouri, but that's not the case. Missouri's great, but my favorite spots along the trail, mostly they're in the West, you know, they're in Montana. I really like a spot called Limhi Pass. It's kind of on the border of Montana and Idaho. I like that mountainous area. That's the part in the story where basically Lewis ascended this mountain range and he expected to kind of get to the top and see the Pacific Ocean right there. And instead, all he saw were more and more mountains and he realized, oh, he had a long way to go still. So I really like that. And then one of the other cool spots along the trail, hopefully I can say this correctly, but there's a trail that's been used for thousands of years by Native Americans called the Kokolarishkit Trail, which means road to the buffalo. Basically a trace where, I mean, so many people have walked this trail over the years. It's just, you could still see this path through the mountains and everything. And I really like that, being able to kind of not only stand where Lewis and Clark stood, but where thousands and thousands of people since time immemorial have really, you know, gone on that path. I think that's a really, really cool spot. And that's in Montana.
Okay.
That's awesome. Were both of those more on the way to the Pacific, or was is any of those on the way back?
So Limhi Pass was on the outbound to the Pacific because that's where he went and said, oh, okay, I still have a long way to go. The road to the buffalo was on the way back. Actually, it was on the return route. And so Lewis and Clark, actually in Montana, the party split up into lots of little subgroups. And so it was only Lewis and a few men from the expedition that would have gone on that road to the buffalo.
Oh, I just think that the whole journey is so cool to me. Like the excitement of getting out on, you know, going west and finding something and then realizing how challenging it's going to be. Like when you get to Limhi Pass, we've come so far.
Yeah.
Just over this mountain, we're probably going to see the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah.
You know, and then realizing, holy smokes,
I got a long way to go still.
We're already out of food, basically.
Exactly.
And we're still carrying so much. I don't know. It's just crazy. And then coming back when they realized, okay, we're on our way back. We still haven't found the Northwest Passage. Let's give it one last go. And then they split up and kind of hope that the northern little spur is going to take them to the right spot.
Yeah, such a challenging part of the expedition for a lot of different reasons. They split into all these parties, which, you know, most experts would say that's a bad idea to kind of like split up into multiple groups. And they had a lot of challenges for that very reason. I mean, that's the one part of the expedition where there was a violent encounter with Native American tribes. There were at least one, if not more, members of the Blackfeet tribe who were killed in an encounter with Meriwether Lewis, and that caused a lot of hard feelings, as it would.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then after that, of course, you know, they were like, okay, we got to get out of here and go home.
Yeah.
You know, and so they booked it down the Missouri River. And it's kind of amazing going through the Lewis and Clark journals and seeing, you know, they didn't really write much on that return in part of the journey. They were just like ready to go back. You know, they were wanting to get to St. Louis.
I can't imagine the idea. Well, they were eating like crap for a lot of the way, you know, whatever they could carry with them or whatever they could kill, basically. So it was probably not necessarily crap, but like probably just really monotonous diets. And so that for me would probably be like the most amazing part of, oh, I just can't wait to get to St. Louis.
Yeah.
I want to have some home cooking.
Sleep exactly, in your own bed. Yeah.
Yes.
That would be crazy. Okay. A couple of questions for you, because I think that the journey is really interesting. It was not only were they trying to just find out what was out there and map it, but they were also trying to figure out how far it was. So I don't know, as someone who is in your mapping and taking care of a lot of things, you're using ArcGIS probably a lot. Like, can you imagine how accurate they basically were on how the distance, how far it was from the beginning of the journey to the end and back?
Yeah, it's always amazing to me. You know, William Clark was the cartographer on the expedition, and it is truly amazing. I think I owe my job to William Clark, actually. You know, the fact that mapping and maps and all of that were so important is probably the reason why the Lewis and Clark Trail has a GIS specialist that focuses solely on mapping it, as opposed to someone in that's a biologist that took a class in college or something and does a little bit of it. So yeah, it is always incredible. I will say one thing that I didn't realize when I started the job was that Lewis and Clark, before they left on their expedition in St. Louis, they were gathering as much information as they could. So they got maps from fur traders and from travelers and from tribes, and they got as much information, and they got books and everything, and they carried that all with them. And so in the first part of the outbound journey on their way up to Fort Mandan, that part of the map had already largely been kind of filled out already. And there's a map called the McKay map, and it's from the 1790s, and it's pretty much identical to Clark's map. You know, the only difference is the labels have been translated from French to English, but that's about it. It's pretty much the same. So
did he plagiarize? Are we saying he played?
No,
I'm just kidding.
I wouldn't say that. I mean, the geography is what it is. So
right. Yeah, that's
just
true.
Redid it. But, you know, he did a great job, but he also had a lot of really, you know, the best information possible as well.
That makes sense. I guess I was thinking they didn't have much, but it's true. People had been out there doing, you know, exploring for a while.
Especially, you know, fur traders had been, in fact, you know, they had a lot of information about kind of who was out there and what was out there up until Fort Mandan in North Dakota. After that, it was a lot more kind of mysterious and we don't really know what's there, but the first part of the journey, they had some information for sure.
This is a would you rather question for the Lewis and Clark expedition.
Okay.
Would you rather care for a baby prairie dog along the whole journey and take it out and back? Or would you rather have a 2-month-old and basically carry a toddler and care for a toddler along the journey, which both happened on this journey, by the way?
Yes, it did. So I would, the prairie dog, I would feel a lot better, I think, caring for the prairie dog. The story about the prairie dog is, you know, in September of 1804 in Nebraska, actually not terribly far from here, they discovered this colony of prairie dogs. They called them barking squirrels.
Okay, that seems right.
Yeah. So they discover, they spend an entire day, everybody on the expedition, trying to catch one. They finally caught a couple of them. I think one of them, they probably ate one, and the other one, they were like, okay, let's keep this one, and we are going to send it back to Thomas Jefferson. So what they did was they carried this prairie dog all the way to Fort Mandan. The prairie dog lived with them in Fort Mandan over the winter, and then they kind of sent a detachment party back down the river with their journals and maps and everything for Thomas Jefferson, and the prairie dog went all the way to Monticello, or at least to the White House or something like that. So Thomas Jefferson had this prairie dog from the Lewis and Clark expedition.
That's so crazy. I'm just imagining these soldiers or explore mountain men. Like, if you've ever watched the first Rocky movie, when Mick is teaching, are you a Rocky fan? Have you seen the Rocky movies?
Yes.
When Mick is telling him to chase and catch the chicken.
Yeah. I mean, they were literally, so I've been to the site too, and they still have prairie dogs there. And it's a long way. Like, so they were carrying buckets of water from the river, hiking up, you know, and then dumping it into the prairie dog holes to try to flush them out.
Eventually, chasing them around the kitchen.
They were doing that too. They were running. 35, 40 men chasing after these little things. And eventually they got a couple. I was going to tell you too, later on, Lewis talks in the journals about eating a prairie dog, and he basically describes that it was, you know, very tender and well-flavored or something like that. And so, I mean, kind of they ate a prairie dog, and then he kind of wrote his little review of it in the journals.
Oh, man, that's awesome. I would imagine, well, now that we know that those prairie dogs sometimes have bubonic plague, it's kind of
yeah.
That meal could have gone a different direction.
Yeah, it sure could have.
Well, what's the story about the baby?
So Sacagawea, or Sacagawea, however you pronounce the name, 2 months before she started on the journey, she gave birth to the child that came to be known as Pomp or Jean-Baptiste. And so, like, I don't know, that just blows my mind. And he came on the journey the whole way.
Oh, I guess I didn't realize that.
Yeah, so he actually ended up having a very interesting life after the expedition. So Sacagawea and her husband, Toussaint Charbonneau, they moved to St. Louis, and they tried to kind of make a living there, but never really did. And so William Clark ended up adopting Jean-Baptiste, and he paid for his education, and he ended up going to Europe and living there with a duke for 6 years. And he was like a scout for the military. He was a gold miner, an explorer, a trader. And he lived in California and lived a very interesting life. He spoke, you know, many languages, German, Spanish, several Native American languages, English. And so, yeah. It's kind of interesting.
That's nuts.
The baby from the expedition ended up kind of having a storied life, and then ended up on, you know, the Sacagawea dollar coin on our currency. Maybe those are probably the only two Native Americans that are on our currency.
Personally, having been a parent and, you know, traveled cross country in a travel trailer very luxuriously compared to this journey, I would choose probably the prairie dog as well.
Probably. Definitely a prairie dog.
I can't even imagine going on this journey into the wild with 30-something men, you know, trying to just explore the wilderness, and you've got a kid. And she was like the hero in so many different ways in a lot of situations. And she's so cool.
Yeah.
She is so cool.
And the other thing that's really important about Sacagawea and Jean-Baptiste is the fact that, you know, there were all these tribes out there who saw suddenly all these strangers, these military guys walking through, and they could have said, okay, this is not good to have these guys coming through our homelands. But then they also saw this woman with a baby, and they're probably thinking, okay, this isn't a war party. Mm-hmm. I don't know who these people are. They're strangers, but you know, they've got a baby with them. They can't be that, you know, serious. So
Yeah.
I think that was something unique about the expedition as well, that they, you know, they had some interesting, it was an interesting collection of people that went on this journey for sure.
It was a motley crew that wasn't really scary to a lot of the native peoples, probably.
Right.
Because of Sacagawea and the baby.
The baby, yep.
So they got a pass in a lot of ways because of that.
Yes.
I think. I'm not the expert. You're the expert, so you can tell me.
So do you have a favorite story about the Lewis and Clark expedition?
Yeah, I have a few, and a couple of them definitely involve Sacagawea. One is that, you know, when they went to Limhi Pass, the area where they were looking out and said they have a long way to go, they met up with the Shoshone tribe. And, you know, one story is that Sacagawea was a Shoshone Indian who had been kind of kidnapped and taken to the Hidatsa and ended up marrying Toussaint Charbonneau and then kind of returned on this expedition to her homeland. And when she did, she, you know, apparently Lewis and Clark and the Corps of Discovery were having a meeting with the Shoshone people, and she's there kind of helping translate. And as she's translating, she realizes that the chief of the Shoshone that she's translating for is her brother. It's her long lost brother that she hasn't seen in years. And apparently, I mean, in the journal they describe, she gets very emotional and is like, oh my gosh, that's my brother. You know, like,
that's crazy.
And here's your nephew. He only speaks French.
I'm getting chills just talking about this. It's kind of weird, but that's one story that I really like. The other thing that I really think is special about the expedition is, and a lot's kind of blown out of proportion about this, but it's still really special. When they went to the Pacific, they finally got there. They had to decide kind of, okay, where are we going to set up camp for the winter? And so they actually had kind of like a vote. It was probably more like a poll of the group. But, you know, Sacagawea, this teenage Native American woman, was allowed to vote for where they spent for the winter. William Clark's manservant, whose name was York, an enslaved African American, was also allowed to vote, you know? And I think that's really a cool moment. It's like way before women had the right to vote or African Americans were allowed to vote on the Lewis and Clark expedition, you know, their voices counted just the same as everybody else's. And I think that's a really cool, special part of the story as well. And I'm getting chills again.
I know, it's so cool. Like, I'm getting them as well just thinking about it. But it's like, on this type of a journey,
yeah,
there is no dead weight. Everybody has to pull their weight. Mm-hmm. And when everybody does pull their weight like that, it's like, of course you're going to get a vote on this type of a situation. If, as long as like the leaders are, you know, good, not tyrannical leaders, basically, and they're realizing the value of every member of the party. And I think that they were pretty good leaders, but that's so cool. It's such a neat, almost a microcosm of the U.S. in a way. It's like, everybody gets a vote. It's awesome.
That's really cool. I want to jump back real quick just to your actual job at Lewis and Clark. I just want to know, what do you think is the coolest part?
The coolest part for me, there's a couple of things that stand out. One is, you know, my job is very much collaborative. Like, I get to work with lots of different people, whether they be my colleagues, different resource professionals, partners, things like that. So that's interesting to me. The other interesting thing is just like the size and the complexity of the Lewis and Clark Trail. It almost goes coast to coast. It's a huge area of the continent. And so there's kind of something for everyone. And also, of course, the Lewis and Clark story is just really unique and special. So that's what I love the most about my job, for sure.
And you mentioned before we started recording that not all people in the Park Service consider everyone a park ranger.
Yeah.
But I'm considering you a park ranger. John said he has a way to differentiate or to make sure. So, John, how are we proving he's a park ranger?
Okay, this is how I decide if someone's a park ranger or not. Do you have one of those wide-brimmed hats?
Yes.
You're a park ranger. That's all it takes. For me, all you have to have...
You just gotta have the hat.
You have to have a hat and a pair of, like, green or khaki pants, and you're good to go.
I've got a lot of those, too. You know, yeah, so when I started the position, we were all in uniform and everything like that. And then over the years, we've kind of... The people who aren't public-facing are not in uniform anymore. I, of course, kept my flat hat, and all my uniform stuff is in boxes all over the place. And every once in a while, my son digs out the flat hat and puts it on and pretends he's a park ranger.
Yeah, you got to keep that around. But that definitely counts. That's what I was telling him in all of my park ranger jobs. But I guess I was always front facing. I worked in interp, or I worked as a visitor assistant. But anyway, we always just referred to everyone as park rangers. So I thought that was really interesting, too, because you're, in our minds, definitely a park ranger. You map the Lewis and Clark National Historic Trail.
Which is, like, the most park ranger-y thing I think you can do. You're still in the core of discovery, basically, is how I see it. That's super cool.
That's funny.
I love that. So a couple of questions that I have, since we talked a little bit about barbecue, and I don't know if this is a good time to segue into that.
Okay. Yeah, we can.
I was wondering, what part of the Lewis and Clark Trail has the best barbecue?
Now this, like, I could talk to you all day about this for sure. This I know, and I can definitely give definitive answers on this. Part of it is because I'm from this area, but Missouri and Kansas City is very well known for barbecue. That's the spot along the trail that has the best barbecue. St. Louis, a little bit less so, but definitely good barbecue there. The other spot along the trail that's kind of known for barbecue is Kentucky. They have their own sort of unique barbecue tradition. It's much less known than Kansas City, but those are the spots. And I've been to every place you can imagine in those three areas for sure.
Do you have a favorite in Kansas City?
I probably get this question every week, which is, where should I go? And Kansas City has over 100 different barbecue places, so it's hard to say, oh, just go to this one spot. But there are, you know, four or five that I typically kind of recommend to people, and they're pretty unique. There's one that's interesting called Chef J Barbecue. They were just recently kind of voted number one in the city, a newer spot. They are located in a haunted house.
What?
Yeah, it's called The Beast. It's one of the haunted houses during Halloween. It's in an old historic part of the city. So you should check out Chef Jay. Very good.
That's awesome. Oh my gosh.
Another interesting spot there is called Buck Tui, and it is a Thai barbecue place. So the pitmaster is half Thai, and he mixes Kansas City barbecue with Thai cuisine. Very interesting, great food.
Oh my gosh, that sounds so good.
Yeah, it's crazy good. It's too good, you know? And then there's another interesting spot. It's got a funny name as well. It's called Night Goat. And it is, it's in a kind of a fine dining restaurant, but on Sundays or on weekends, they turn it into a barbecue joint. And they serve, I mean, very high-end kind of food. You know, they also serve barbecue, but they do it with a kind of a high-end twist. They've got impeccable credentials as chefs and have worked in New York and fine dining restaurants, but Kansas City is lucky to have them as well. Literally, you could throw a stick and hit a good barbecue restaurant in Kansas City.
Do you just eat your way through when you go? That sounds so good.
I've been to many, many, many barbecue, way too many barbecue places in KC.
I watched some cooking shows as like where they were doing like battles or like competitions between barbecue. And, you know, depending on what part of the country you're in, it seems like some favor saucy and some favor rubs. Does the Lewis and Clark Trail go through saucy sections and rubby sections?
Yeah. And so Kansas City is a very sauce heavy kind of, that's kind of what Kansas City is known for. And then the unique thing about Kentucky is they serve kind of mutton, because that's kind of the only spot where mutton is like the big sort of an interesting choice of protein in that state.
Is that good or is it weird?
It's weird, but good, just because it's different. Because a lot of times, you know, I travel around a lot and go to different places. And a lot of times, like, every place is the same. So it's nice to have something different. I don't know that I would eat that every meal, though.
I feel like anywhere where you can order mutton, you should be able to order haggis at the same time. That just seems like it should go together for me. Can you barbecue haggis? That sounds good.
I don't know.
That could be a new staple for the barbecue tourist. Barbecued haggis.
Yeah, maybe.
That sounds awful. So another question I wanted to ask you is, because the Corps of Discovery, they were hunting so often, and sometimes they were trying new meat that they had never experienced before. Do you ever get jealous of their diet, or do you ever find, like, have you crafted a Lewis and Clark cookbook for all the different kinds of game that they were eating?
So there are at least a couple of cookbooks that kind of focus on that. I'm not really jealous of them for eating prairie dog and stuff like that, but it is kind of interesting that they got to eat all this different kinds of meat and experience it for the first time and everything. I have barbecued and grilled bison and elk before. Actually, here in Omaha, just outside of Omaha, there's this really unique butcher shop. They sell a steak that they call the Meriwether, and it is the hump of a bison.
Whoa.
Oh.
And it's kind of seasoned with salt and pepper, and it includes a little strip of bacon that you've flick a little bacon fat. So you can throw that in the skillet and fry the steak in bacon.
Oh my gosh.
Bacon fat. And it is actually incredible. It doesn't have a beef taste. It sort of tastes more like ham. But it's really interesting. Bison hump. It's kind of a interesting.
That is now on my bucket list, man. That sounds awesome.
You should come visit me and we'll go get the Meriwether and we'll cook it.
That's awesome.
Oh my gosh.
That sounds so good.
Yeah.
Oh man. That's all I can think about at the moment. So this is something that I thought would be so disappointing. We talked about earlier how excited they probably were to be home and all the different comforts of home they were probably experiencing. But they were still hunting, and on the way back, I think it was William Clark that went hunting, and his hunting companion was nearsighted, and he got shot in the rear because his buddy couldn't really see him, right? Is that the story?
Yeah, so it was Meriwether Lewis. Yeah, he got shot in the backside, as you'd say, and
it looked like a buffalo hump. That's my train of thought.
Yeah, yeah. That's what the guy says. So the gentleman was a river guide, and he was actually kind of blind in one eye and from kind of staring at the water constantly and everything. So kind of the story is that, oh, he couldn't see very well and he mistook Meriwether Lewis for a deer or something like that because he was wearing buckskin, I'm sure, and shot him in the backside. And unfortunately, you know, I'm sure it really hurt. And I think he was probably very upset. And I think he rode down the Missouri River for quite a ways, you know, on his stomach because he was, you know, wounded.
Oh, no.
But yeah, that's a kind of a funnier story, I guess. It probably wasn't funny at the time, but yeah.
Exactly. You're on the last leg of the journey and you get shot in the rump.
And then you shoot your boss in the backside. So yeah, that's bad. But his performance review was not very good.
Yeah. Well, I didn't think about it until when you said boss. I'm like, maybe that was his, like, he's been making me keep the worst watch every night for nine months.
You know, there are people that kind of say that too, that, hey, maybe he was sending them a message like, hey, we'll take you out. You know, don't push us too hard or whatever. I don't know.
Oh my gosh.
I would say he probably couldn't see very well.
Yeah, that's probably true. We'll give him the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
And that he was just so hungry, dreaming of a Meriwether steak.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And he got a Clark steak instead. It's bad.
Well, you said it was Meriwether Lewis,
right?
It was
Meriwether Lewis, yes.
So it was a Meriwether steak.
Okay. Oh, that's right. I got my brain.
Yeah, he got a Meriwether.
Yeah.
Not the steak he was looking for.
Exactly. Oh, man. So do you have any specific recipes or ways that, what is your favorite game meat that they would have eaten on the trail?
So I guess you would consider bison to be in that category. I actually cook quite a lot of bison because we have a company here in Nebraska called Central Nebraska Buffalo, and they serve all these different cuts, and I've cooked all of them.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
I like to grill those and smoke them. The only thing you have to really watch with any game meat is they are a lot cleaner. They have a lot less fat than all the meat that you get at the store. And so It's really easy to kind of overcook them, to dry them out and make them kind of, you know, not that great to eat. So kind of less is more. You just put them on the grill and you watch them and make sure you don't dry them out, and you should be good to go.
That sounds so good.
Nice. Do you make your own sausage?
I do not.
Okay. Because I was just thinking, like, when we were in Kansas recently, I tried a few sausages. It was just, there's some such, that's my favorite kind of processed meat, I guess, if you could say it that way. But
there is a Lewis and Clark sausage, and this, I was kind of thinking about this. So Sacagawea's husband cooked them a sausage called Boudin Blanc, which I think you can still get in New Orleans and everything, but it's, they use the intestine of a buffalo and stuffed it with meat and everything. And it's a white sausage.
It sounds like the haggis we were talking about.
Yeah. That same butcher shop I was talking about earlier, their name is Cure in Fort Calhoun. I'll give them a shout out. But yeah, they also serve that Lewis and Clark Boudin Blanc as well. You know, they've done all this research on different recipes from the period and came up with that as well. So that's pretty cool. And I did cook it. I didn't make the sausage, but I cooked it, and it was really, really delicious.
This is probably going to put you in hot water, depending with some of your audience. What do you personally prefer? Do you like the pellet versus charcoal, or do you use chips, or, you know, how do you like to barbecue? What do you use? What is your equipment?
Well, so I have tons of grills, just so you know. I have everything under the sun. I have a pit barrel. I have a Weber. I have a huge Horizon offset cooker that weighs 1,000 pounds. I have a pellet grill, everything under the sun, and I use all of them all the time. So I'm not one of those, oh, you can only do this. Having said that, I do prefer charcoal and wood. That's what I use the most. And I cook almost kind of every day outside on the grill when the weather's nice in Nebraska, which that cuts out a few months of the year. But yeah, I use several different kinds of grills. I really like smoking the, you know, on the pit barrel and on the Horizon offset and things like that.
That sounds so good.
Have you ever made one of your own, like, creations? Some people cut in half, like a 55-gallon barrel, or turn it into something. Have you done any of that?
No, that's a lot of work. No, I'm not handy enough for that. I wish I could.
I'm thinking the same thing. There's the wheel has already been invented, so I'm going to go ahead and... That's awesome.
Oh my gosh, so cool. Ryan Cooper, you are a park ranger at Lewis and Clark National Historic Trail, mapping the trail, doing all sorts of stuff. You also have a huge Instagram about barbecue. So tell us and tell our audience where people can find you, especially if they want to know more about barbecue, but they can also come visit you at Lewis and Clark.
Yeah. So my barbecue handle on all social media channels is Barbecue Tourist or BBQ Tourist. So you can find me on Instagram. I also am the co-founder of a weekly barbecue publication called The Smoke Sheet. And we are on Substack. You could subscribe on Substack. There's a free version. And then there's like a small paid version as well that gets you even more barbecue news if you just can't get enough. And so every week we write stories about our travels. We write about recipes and the latest news. We recommend podcasts. I hope to recommend this podcast. And and we share that. And that's at bbqnewsletter.substack.com is where you can sign up for that as well.
And I have one last question for you, because I really want to know. I know you're getting ready to go on a trip with your family, but I want to know, what national park right now is at the top of your bucket list?
Oh my gosh. I guess I've been planning this trip for months and months and months. And so I've been to all the parks in Utah, but there are some that I have seen less than others. And so I've been to Zion several times. I've been to Bryce Canyon, but I guess I'm most excited to go to Arches. I have been there before, but I'm going to be going there with my 10-year-old son. He's in fourth grade, so he got his Every Kid Outdoors pass.
Nice.
And then my dad is going to go as well. And so it's going to be pretty interesting to... It's all levels of energy and fitness, you know, from my son who wants to go everywhere to my aging father, who probably wants to sit in the car and look at the arches from there.
That's honestly the best park for that, truthfully.
Good.
There's so many different things you can do.
And I've downloaded all the episodes of this podcast to listen to on the way, because we got a long drive to Zion from Omaha. So we're going to get all our tips from you guys.
Are you hitting all five Utah parks, or are you just doing a couple? Or
yes, we're hitting all five. We're starting, our first park is Mesa Verde. That's the first.
Oh, cool.
The first one we are going to, and we're staying in the lodge in the park on that. And then
Nice. From
there, we're going through Canyonlands and heading to Arches. And we'll be there for Earth Day, I believe. So, and then National Parks Week as well. So
nice.
Yeah,
perfect.
It's going to be great.
Do you think the inside of your car gets hot enough to cook something while you're like on a hike?
Ooh,
so you can come back?
Probably, well, I don't know. In April, it might not be.
Yeah, probably not in April.
Not too bad. But yeah, if we went in July, yeah. I could take the Meriwether steak and just put it in the back window.
That would be awesome.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. It was so fun to talk to you about all the different things that you know. How fascinating. There's a lot I didn't know. So thank you. And everybody go check him out at BBQ Tourist on Instagram, especially if you're hungry and especially if you want some good barbecue spots along the Lewis and Clark National Historic Trail.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, that was awesome. I sure enjoyed talking with Ryan, the BBQ Tourist. Man, that was just so much fun.
I know. I learned a lot, actually. You know a lot more about the Lewis and Clark Trail and the expedition that I do. Mm-hmm. So I feel like pretty much all of that information was new for me.
Yeah, there's so much going on. They covered so much ground, so many different parts of the country. And their journey was overall in U.S. history, not that long a period of time, but for explorers to document that whole trip, there's just so much that we could have covered. We'd barely scratched the surface, and it was awesome.
Yeah. And how cool is his job? What a cool thing to do. Yeah. Modern day mapper.
It's a modern day version of what Lewis and Clark were doing. He's like exploring and mapping and doing a bunch of cool stuff and eating really good barbecue along the way.
We're going to Kansas City, man. We're heading out there. We're going to go hit some barbecue. I want to go stop at some more of these sites along the Lewis and Clark National Historic Trail. I was looking at it. So they have a whole map on the National Park Service website. So if you're interested in going here, take a look, because they have marked like all the different visitor centers and sites that you can stop along this trail. And as Ryan said, not all of it's run by the National Park Service. They're kind of coordinating this effort between a lot of different things and people who want to preserve the history of this trail. And there are some national park sites too. Like I was looking and I was like, well, we've been to Fort Clatsop. That's in Astoria, Oregon. That's the very end of their trail. And that's really cool. I also noticed that like the Little Bighorn Battlefield is right along that area too. And we've been there.
Yep.
So that's really cool. That's another national park site, but there's a lot of visitor centers and little stops and information centers and stuff that are run by other people too. And all of that is on that map on the National Park Service website.
So cool. It's just so much fun. Oh, makes me want to get out there on the trail and do some fun things and just experience what they did.
We'll have to visit those places that he mentioned too, of his favorite spot. Looks like we're going to Montana.
Heck yeah, we are. We're going to look up that point and just be like, oh my gosh, I couldn't imagine thinking that I was at the end of my mountaineering and realizing I'm not even close. So for your task today, we would love it if you would go to Instagram, look him up, BBQ Tourist, and thank him so much for coming on to the podcast. Give him some thoughts on maybe your favorite part of the Lewis and Clark Trail or your favorite kind of barbecue. I don't know, but just show him some love and thank him for coming on the podcast.
And thank you for exploring the national parks with us today. We can't wait to see you out on the trail. And don't forget to get some dirt in your shoes.